good stuff.
Hello. Hi, my name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm several things for the MSU Libraries. One thing is I'm the coordinator for humanities collections, which includes music in the Fine Arts Library. I serve several capacities, but also one of my jobs is to coordinate these film series, these event series for the MSU Libraries. There's three of them. There's a writer's series, there's a colloquia series, of which this is a part, and there's a film series. For some reason, they're all happening within the next 3 weeks. So almost everything we're doing for all the series are happening in the next 3 weeks. There's a lot going on. There's a couple flyers up here for a few events that are coming up. And one more is coming up that's not even on the official schedule yet. So I should say a few words about why we do these things in the first place. The library has events to advertise and showcase services and collections that we've been doing for years, and going forward, music is one of them. So it's a good partnership that we have with Harlan, Professor Jennings, and what we're calling his series, what he's calling, which is a co-sponsored event with the colloquia series. It's Music in American Life. Yes, thank you. So, you know, as we have film events, I usually advertise that all the films that we show are right down the hallway in the Digital Multimedia Center, which has a collection of over 5,000 feature films these days, which makes it one of the biggest, it makes it the biggest academic library collection in the state. This particular event especially is to advertise, in part anyway, collections in the music library. And this particular collection is actually in the MSU archives, which I'm sure you'll talk about. Okay, so thank you, everyone, especially thank you, Harlan. So Mary Black Juntinen has worked in the service of the MSU libraries for nearly 50 years, the last 39 as a professional librarian and more specifically as the music librarian. Beyond Mary's usual duties of purchasing, caring for, and arranging the electronic and analog materials of interest, to those who study music at MSU, as well as the answering questions about music research from this patronage, Mary also well serves her role as MSU faculty by serving as the editor of reviews for Fontes Musicae, which is an academic journal. Am I saying that correctly? Thank you. And she also serves as the director of several local choruses, including the MSU Russian Chorus. And lately, by giving talks around the world, actually, about the MSU Library's growing collection of the papers and scores of local composers, such as the Verdier Trio. A paper on the MSU Archives/Library collection of the R. Nathaniel Dett papers, for instance, was given by Mary at the International Association of Music Librarians Conference in 2012 in Montreal, of which I'm sure she'll talk quite a bit about tonight. So please welcome Mary Black Juntinen.
Hello and welcome. Which one am I using? Both? Okay. Yes, I knew we had this collection of material of Nathaniel Dett, and periodically I would have reason to look up Nathaniel Dett in the catalog, and I would always see this little collection in the archives that said our Nathaniel Dett papers, and it had a little blurb about his life saying that he was born in Canada and that he died in Michigan. Well, when we had the conference in Montreal, they were particularly interested in papers that related Canadian and American composers, musicians of all stripes. And so I prepared a proposal to talk about Nathaniel Dett, which gave me an excuse to go over and have a look at the papers in the MSU archives. If you've not been there, it's over in Conrad Hall, which is just east of Wharton Center. And it has actually now quite a lot of material of MSU composers because we had moved a number of things out of the special collections unit of the library into the archives. The Dett collection, however, had been given directly to the archives. So what we had in the main part of the music library were some of his piano music, recordings of his piano music, and not too much else. We have some books about him. And it's interesting that he was probably the most, or one of the most, famous African-American composers of his time, primarily the 1920s and 30s, in the classical field. Now, today, everyone probably knows the names of many of the African-American jazz musicians, the jazz singers, all of those types, and hardly anyone knows about the classical people. But Nathaniel Dett was known nationally and internationally. And so the purpose of this talk is to give some biography on this man and then to show you some examples of things that we have in the collections over in the archives. If you have questions at any point, or if you would like to save them up for later, I'd be happy to answer whatever I can. And I would encourage you, if you're interested at all in this collection, to go over and have a look. He was best known as a composer of choral music, which I understand most of you, if not all of you, are singers. So this should be of some interest to you. He was renowned as a pianist, a composer, an arranger, a perpetual student, a concert arranger and promoter, a conductor, and a chamber musician. His legacy lives on in the Nathaniel Dett Chorale, which is based in Toronto. They travel around the US and Canada giving concerts. That is a mixed chorus, and they don't specifically do just Nathaniel Dett. They have a number of different programs they do, but they're named for Nathaniel Dett. And there is also possibly another chorus in Washington, D.C. If you want to look up his name in our catalog, you need to look Dett R. Nathaniel. That is his official name. His first real name was Robert. And as you can see from the slide, he was a pretty handsome young man when this was taken. This was from a photograph that was in use at his main institution, Howard University. His piano music is still often played and recorded, but a lot less of the choral material has been used. And he also wrote a number of solo pieces, which I'll come to in a minute. He was born October 11th, 1882. We're almost at his birthday. I didn't even realize that before. Two more days and we'd have his birthday. He was born in Drummondsville, Ontario, which later became a part of Niagara Falls. His mother was Canadian and his father was American. They were both of African descent. His maternal grandmother is known to have moved to Ontario from Washington, D.C. in the 1850s, and so his mother was born there. She and her brother grew up in Drummondsville. His father was born near Baltimore, Maryland, and really that's about all that's known about his antecedents. The town of Drummondsville was a major stop on the Underground Railroad before and during the American Civil War. And so there's some thought that his family may have migrated, at least in part, due to those types of conditions, but nobody really knows. And the records haven't been kept all that well. He remembered that his grandmother sang some spirituals and other songs based on her Southern heritage, but he really had no other information about her. The grandmother lived with him for a good many years, and she was a very strong-willed and influential person. He had two older brothers, one of whom became a postal clerk in Niagara Falls for nearly 50 years, and the second brother was killed at the age of 15 while playing a Halloween prank, and a younger sister died at the age of 2. So for most of his growing up years then, he was one of three boys, and they were a very well-cultured and well-educated family. When he was about 8 or 9, the family moved across the St. Lawrence River to Niagara Falls, New York, and he and his two brothers continued to go to school in Ontario by special permission for several years. As I said, they were middle class, they were well-educated, they were influential in the arts and cultures of both Niagara Falls, Ontario, and Niagara Falls, New York. They went back and forth freely, and they had a lot of influence in both communities, among both the white and the black families. In New York, they opened a 17-room boarding house, which operated successfully for a number of years, and then his father took a job on the railroad, which kept him away from the family. The parents ultimately separated. The parents had both had some musical training. They were providing piano lessons for the boys, and when Nathaniel heard his older brother's piano lessons, he would often sit down and mimic everything they played. So the teacher said she would give him lessons for free. And so he began to play regularly, although later on they said it was hard for him to play what was on the page. He liked to improvise, and it was only when he became a teenager that he had a teacher who said, you will not improvise, you will play Beethoven the way he wrote it. So he had to hold off on his improvising for the right circumstances. He was often known as Nate as a child, but later on he was mainly called Nathaniel. His parents separated when he was about 14, and he took a job as a bellhop in a local hotel. When he didn't have anything else to do, he could sit at the piano and play, and that's where he could improvise to his heart's content. While he was there, a number of influential people and wealthy people heard him play, and a piano teacher from Germany heard him there and began to give him serious lessons, and he was the one who made him toe the line. And he finished his education in the New York Falls, New York school system. He then went on to attend Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. He was there from 1903 to 1908. And I'm going to find my map here. Well, maybe. I think this is where I have to do this. Yes, okay, sorry. Too many pieces of technology here. As you can see, there's a little red button here. There we go. Niagara Falls, Ontario is there. Niagara Falls, New York is just across. Oberlin is here. So already, as a teenager, he wasn't very far from Michigan. He was at Oberlin because they were one of the only higher education institutions to accept, as they put it, youths are received as members irrespective of color. Because, of course, there was a great deal of prejudice at that time. He was already composing music, he was performing, he was a choir director in the Oberlin community while he was in school. He graduated in 1908 with a double major in piano and composition, and he was the first African American to graduate with that type of degree. He returned to Oberlin for advanced study in the summer of 1913, and in 1926 he was given an honorary doctorate by Oberlin. Until he heard Dvorak's American Quartet, the string quartet, in college, he had avoided using spirituals or other black music because he thought that it was demeaning to the culture to do that. But once he heard what Dvorak had done with spirituals and other themes in the quartet, he realized that there was a great deal of dignity and inspiration to be had in these texts and the melodies, so he began to include them. Now, that wasn't the only thing he did, but he certainly opened his eyes to what could be done with his own heritage. One of his most enduring pieces is called Listen to the Lambs, and it was written in 1914 and was based on a well-known spiritual. But when people think of spirituals today, and even at this time, they often think of the more powerful applause or clapping and very rhythmic type of spiritual, and by and large, his works are not that way. They are more thoughtful and they are more sensitive to the innuendos and deeper meanings of the text that he was setting. In fact, some people accused him throughout his life when he would write these spiritual settings. They would accuse him of not having proper religious feeling because he didn't write like many of the other people did for these types of compositions. After his graduation, he had two short-term positions at Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee, and Lincoln Institute in Jefferson City, Missouri, which is now Lincoln University. And then, in 1913, he was hired by Hampton Institute, which is now Hampton University, in Hampton, Virginia. He taught there from 1913 through the spring of 1931. And each of these institutions, Lane College, Lincoln Institute, and Hampton, were African-American schools. He was highly regarded at each location. He worked in each community as a pianist, as a conductor, and as a composer, in addition to his scheduled work at the institution. At Hampton, he taught many subjects, but he especially developed the choirs. He composed, arranged, and accompanied music for them. He gave concerts with the choirs. He built a national and international reputation. He took the choirs on tours around the US. He took them to Russia and London and every other place in Europe where he could get an audience. And they were very much appreciated. He also toured separately as a pianist and in chamber music whenever he could, and he performed his own works and those of others. And both of the Niagara Falls communities in Ontario and New York followed his career with great interest. Now, just for a little change of pace, I'm going to play Dett's setting, written in 1918, of America the Beautiful. This is the one we sing now as, "Oh, beautiful for spacious skies," and it has a long, flowing melody, but he has an entirely different take on it. And here we are. Oh, I'm supposed to hide that, aren't I? Listen to that, the more I like it. And the more I listen to it, the more I like it better than the one that we sing so often. There's just something really special about it, I think. That's an individual taste, but I've now had the opportunity to hear it a number of times. In 1916, Nathaniel married Helen Elise Smith. They were married in New York City. They had two daughters, and they spent most of their early life, in Washington, D.C., which we have on the map down here. So you can see his trajectory from here to here to here and then down there. I didn't put the other ones on because he was there a relatively short period of time. Helen was a pianist, a fine concert pianist, and they had two children together, but they both continued to perform and teach, and she critiqued his works, apparently not always with the most gentle of comments, because she considered herself his equal in terms of her knowledge and experience. She apparently didn't have any actual experience with choral works, but she understood the music very well. Dett's teaching load at Hampton Institution was very strict and very stiff, and so that sometimes caused some problems with the marriage. They never divorced, but they really went their separate ways a great deal. The administration of Hampton Institute required him to spend 50 hours a week on his academic and institutional pursuits. So any concerts or composing or performing that he did that wasn't directly connected to Hampton was outside those 50 hours. And so he wasn't home a great deal, and his two daughters actually ended up with inheriting great gifts from both parents, but wanting nothing to do with music. And I suppose it's because they had such absentee parents in part. As Dett's career developed, he became familiar with many American musicians, musicians from abroad, and one of his special friends was Percy Grainger. Today we often think of him as a band conductor, but he wrote a great deal of instrumental music and vocal music, and they were very good friends. And he would often turn to Grainger and ask for advice on compositions or even on travel arrangements, because Grainger went around the world, having been born in Australia, lived in England, lived in the US. He was very much up on those international types of tours. Det also continued to study all his life. He went to Paris and studied with Nadia Boulanger. He took classes again at Oberlin, at the University of Wisconsin, at Columbia University, and several others. He was always learning, studying psychology, community music, counterpoint, whatever seemed to him like he needed to beef up on it or learn something more about it. And he also loved to write, and he became a published poet. So he had many different aspects of his work. In 1931, to everyone's great surprise, Hampton Institute asked him to resign. And to this day, the reasons for that are not really made clear. I suspect that somewhere in the files, there's some paperwork, but it wasn't made public. And a lot of famous people tried to intervene on his behalf, but they would not budge. And eventually, he agreed to resign, despite the fact that he was one of their very, very best professors in any field of endeavor. And he had all this international fame and American fame, but they were done. So he took a leave of absence, and he studied at Eastman and acquired a master's degree in 1932 and did a little more study in 1933. Also in 1930, his health began to fail, and his doctors were concerned for his heart. They told him to work less, relax more, spend more time away from the work, and take better care of himself. Well, you can imagine, with that kind of a background, how much he obeyed that particular restriction. And, in fact, he still had to earn a living. In 1932, he moved his family up to New York, to Rochester, which is fairly close to the second Red Star up there, a little bit to the east. And there he worked as a lecturer whenever he could. He had a lot of correspondence with people around the country and around the world. He toured, he formed choirs. He did all the things he'd been doing before, only without a steady paycheck. He held various short-term posts from 1932 to 1941, including a stint at Bennett College in North Carolina. So he was in great demand, and he would go in and fill in for people who were on sabbatical or otherwise away, but he wasn't getting steady work. He published quite a bit of music with J. Fisher and G. Shermer, and then he switched over to Mills music in 1941. Out of that group, G. Shermer is the only one that's still a going concern, and they've been bought by Hal Leonard, I think. So the copyright situation is really mixed, and I was speaking a little bit with David Rail and some of the others about whether some of this music could be revived, but trying to figure out who owns what is going to be a major occupation in itself. There was a summer camp called Yaddo, where there's a McDowell colony now and several other of these places where people, artists, musicians, writers, poets can go live in a cabin by themselves for a little while in nature and have stimulating company when they want it and be on their own when they didn't. So he had a summer devoted to that and really found that a very helpful thing. But his health never recovered. During this time, he did write a number of more choral pieces, and he had a protege whose name was Dorothy Maynor. Have you heard of her, anyone? Dorothy Maynor, well, you've heard of Marian Anderson, I presume. Some of you, anyway. Marian Anderson was the most famous African-American concert artist in the 1930s, 40s, and into the 50s. Dorothy Maynor was the second most famous, and she had a fabulous soprano voice. So Nathaniel Dett had her as a protege at Hampton, and then he continued to write songs for her. And later on, I'll tell you of a connection between her and Michigan State. During this time, it was also necessary for him to continue making a living. He had a wife who was working, he had two daughters, and he had to continue to make a house payment and so forth. So in February of 1943, the USO, the United Service Organization, offered him a position assisting with the troops, entertainment of the troops around the country. Remember, this is the middle of World War II, and the troops would often be stationed in one place for training for a period of time, and the idea was that the USO would go in and provide entertainment either by bringing in groups or by conducting bands, starting orchestras, choirs, etc. So his idea was that it would be less pressure than some of the academic positions, and that it would aid the war cause and would give him a steady income. So he took that job. And in August of 1943, he was assigned to Fort Custer in Battle Creek, Michigan. That's our little arrow there in the center of the state, more or less. He was assigned there to be entertainment director for the troops. While he was there, he created a women's army chorus, the WACS. He created a men's chorus. He created an all-city chorus. And he wrote music for each one as needed. He was also actively associated with the city's first Congregational Church, where he became reacquainted with a former Oberlin associate, the organist Paul Eichmeier. But after just being there a few weeks, on September 22, 1943, he suffered a heart attack, and he was hospitalized in Battle Creek. He suffered a second series of heart attacks and died in Battle Creek on October 2, 9 days short of his 61st birthday. There are a number of memorial services, of course. There was one in Battle Creek, one at Hampton University, one at Bennett College. His funeral was actually held in Rochester, New York, where the church was, where he was last in position as choir director. And he was buried in Niagara Falls, Ontario. So that complete circle of being born and dying there and or being buried there was maintained. And now the family's original church is named for him. I'll see if I can find it here. That was our famous website. Oh, there it is. This was a log church where the family attended services in the 1800s. And it was originally some blocks away from this. And they put it on logs and moved it to this current site. And it is now a library, but it's named in honor of Dett. And it's the R. Nathaniel Dett British Methodist Episcopal Church. And it is a wood frame with modest porch and these lancet windows. And there's actually quite a description of it on the Historic Places website for Canada. So that is a memorial for him that is in Niagara Falls now. Now, that concludes the life of Nathaniel Dett. Meanwhile, how did we get the material here? Well, Paul Eichmeier, the organist from Battle Creek, moved to Lansing, and he was organist at St. Paul's Episcopal Church for many years in downtown Lansing. Upon his death, his personal collection of organ music was donated to the MSU Library. I actually cataloged a good deal of it. And somehow the Dett collection that he already had in a big folder was separated from that and given to the MSU Archives. They created a finding aid with just the titles. They don't have anything about what the music is, so I needed to go over and actually look at it. Didn't say if it was soprano and alto or SATB or any of those types of details that we singer, choral musician types want to know, just a list of titles. And there are some newspaper clippings, a brief bio. There are 16 individual choral compositions, which is a small portion of what he actually wrote. Three of them are autographed. There are four volumes of what he called the Dett Collection of Negro Spirituals, his own arrangements, and then individual volumes of his 8 Bible vignettes for piano, some autographed envelopes, newspaper clippings, and 2 manuscripts. Now there again, it was not possible to tell beforehand that there were manuscripts in that collection, but that was what really the most interesting to me in the beginning. Biographers estimate that he published 40 choral works, in addition to 2 collections of spirituals, 2 extended works for chorus, soloists, and orchestra, and several well-known piano works. Most of his choral works are a cappella. Even though he was a fantastic pianist, most of the choral works, I think, were a cappella because he could take the choir anywhere. I know with one of the choirs I conduct, the Russian chorus, we don't use accompaniment, so we can pick up and sing on a street corner or in the back of the room, and we don't have to worry about the accompaniment. And that would be a big advantage to these touring choirs that Dett was using. Most of these works are out of print. They are not in any collections, and only a few of them have been recorded. The piano music, of course, has been better represented by recordings and editions. The pieces for chorus and orchestra and for orchestra alone are, as far as I know, unpublished, and we have no representation of those here on campus. But there are 2 manuscripts in the MSU collection, and these are known only because of the Battle Creek newspaper's obituary, where they are mentioned as having been written for the First Congregational Church. Let's see what I'm doing here. Okay. The first one is called Brooks Miller. It's also alternately known as Our God is Good. And I do not know whether the church in Battle Creek has any copies of this. It's something I figure someday I'll find out. I'll get down there and find out from them. Or whether St. Paul's Episcopal has it. I'm assuming not. As far as I know, this is unpublished. It was written in honor of the pastor of the church, Reverend Carlton Brooks Miller, who was observing his 25th anniversary at that church. There is only this one verse. It's possible that there are more verses because the poet, the hymnist John Hampton Gurney, lived from 1802 to 1862, and he wrote the text in 1838. He was a very well-known English clergyman and poet. So it's very likely that there are some other ones around. Now, this manuscript was pretty faint. Our graphic artist here in the library did a good job of bringing this up, but it's really not that clear. However, I did rewrite this and recorded it. So I'll play that for you. Okay. Goes by quickly. With all the singers in the room, you could probably have sung this. When I gave the presentation in Montreal, I could hear some people humming along. But, There we are. Sorry. Sometimes you get in the, I don't want to do this yet. The next piece that was a on the slide, the next piece that was a manuscript is this introduction to God's trumpet wakes the weary world, wakes the slumbering world. That's a poem by Samuel Longfellow, and in according to the newspaper article, it was written as a fanfare to be performed at the church by high school and adult choirs. And we have this introduction, which does clearly indicate some kind of instrumental accompaniment, probably organ. And then that's what the original looks like. So it was really much more difficult. I did not yet put this one together so that we could record it. And we made a slightly enlarged one here. So you can see it's a four-part thing. It's a little bit more dissonant than the other two works I've played so far. It has the little fanfares in the middle there and in the top line and further down. So definitely it was going to be a more complex piece and had some kind of accompaniment. But that did not come with it either. So whether it was meant to be brass or organ, it's really hard to tell. It's possibly organ, because the organ could just play from this score if the person happened to be Nathaniel Dett, who was playing it and could read his own handwriting, which is sometimes a bit of a trick. So that one is a longer piece and would really be worth polishing up and doing a performance of that sometime. A lot of people think that this is a patriotic text, and if so, it's only the third patriotic text he ever set, the first one being America the Beautiful, and then there was another one in between. And there's quite a bit of chromatic passage in here, plus the triplet, so it's just generally a more complicated work that would have taken more time to rehearse than the other one, which The chorus people that you heard were members of my Russian chorus and my church choir, and we put that together in about 15 minutes. It was easy enough to put those into practice. This one, not so much. Another thing in the collection is this envelope in which probably some of the music was written originally, was handled. It's a note to Paul Eichmeier, and there are also two dedications on sheet music published in 1941. We can't really tell what the date is on some of them, but this particular one says, "Dear Paul, here is the copy of the Hymn to Parnassus and some other material. I'm off to Detroit with the wax and then to Rochester for the flowing garments, Nathaniel." There is no date. It's almost certainly 1943 because that's the only time he was actually in Battle Creek working with this friend, Paul Eichmeier. The hymn that he refers to was a solo work for soprano and piano. It has not been published in the collections that we had here in the archives, but it was published in 1942. And I was telling someone about this the other day, mentioning the flowing garments and how this had to have been written shortly before he died. And they were getting all spooky about the flowing garments being the robes of righteousness that he would wear after he died. But I think there was probably some more mundane reason for this. He surely didn't have a premonition that he was going to be dying. But we don't know why he was going back to Rochester. But it clearly shows that his chorus of women was ready for public performance after just a few weeks, and because they were going on a concert tour. There's another one here, one of his published editions from Mills Choral Department, which says, "To Paul from his grateful, admiring friend, R.N. Dett." And then September, either 2nd or 7th, can't be sure, probably 7th, 1943. The next one on the copy of Ask for the Old Paths. To Paul, to Paul, To Mr. Paul Eichmeier with the compliments and best wishes of the composer R. Nathaniel Dett, September 7th, 1943. So he really thought a lot of his friend. He gave them a lot of this music directly, and much of it is still there in that collection. He had a wide-ranging list of poets that he liked to use and a wide source of materials. So be way far beyond the spirituals that he became known for. He had also even taken a lute song by Thomas Campion, and he arranged the lute tablature for voices. And I'm going to play that next. It's an 11-bar phrase. Mostly the chorus hums in the background. There's one verse where they sing the words. He takes exactly, the chorus is exactly what the lute tablature was, the phrasing is the same, and the solo voice is the voice part as written by Campion. This is the one that snuck in a little bit earlier. didn't, with that fan up there, it's a little harder to hear than what would be great, but that's what it is, and that was based on the psalm. Whoop. Okay. I don't expect things to do things on their own. So, as I pointed out, he used poets from many backgrounds. Isaac Watts, Paul Gerhardt, the poet Byron, biblical texts, his own poetry. He used traditional spiritual tunes. He collected songs from other countries. He very seldom used the so-called black dialects that were so common in music of that time. He preferred to work in standard choral forms, and there are some interesting things like a setting of Ave Maria with a Latin text and then a completely different set of English words. It is not a translation in English. It's a completely different poem. So he was very creative in what he did and how often he could make use of all this material. There's very little influence in his music of jazz, blues, swings, and only a few things that you might consider popular. It just was not his style at all. Now, I mentioned tie-ins to Michigan State, besides the fact that we have this debt collection. Dorothy Maynor lived from 1910 to 1996, the second most famous African-American classical singer. She studied at Hampton, was a protege of Jett. She founded the Harlem School of the Arts, which was a very well-known institution. The fan just went off. Now we should play all the music again. She was accompanied on many occasions by Ernst Victor Wolf. He was a German pianist of Jewish background who ended his career at Michigan State. He fled from Germany in the 1930s. I have a collection of his stuff in there in the Fine Arts Library waiting to be archivally indexed. A lot of it is in German. He revived the interest in the U.S. in harpsichord music, which was almost never being played in the 1930s. His family donated his material to MSU, and much of the vocal music is music that he used to accompany Dorothy Maynor. There's one setting of French carols in there where he has written, it's clear in his hand, the different singers doing different keys, different verses. His diary is there, and a number of other things. But Dorothy Maynor and Fritz Kreisler were two of the people that he accompanied the most in his lifetime. So when I saw Dorothy Maynor in the debt papers, I thought, wow, I really need to get that other collection indexed someday. And then recently, Forrest Coggan, who was a choreographer who spent many years at Michigan State, he was visiting here, and I was telling him about the debt collection and how debt ended up in Fort Custer in Battle Creek at the Army base. And he said, well, in 1950, I was the entertainment director there. And so, again, we have a strange little, somewhat delayed, but a tie-in to someone whose career at Michigan State was very prominent and who has donated a very large collection of materials to Michigan State, including works that he choreographed with our own composers, H. Owen Reed and several other people, whose names, if you don't know, you should. You can ask me about them later. And I'll be happy to tell you about these faculty members who have been so instrumental in bringing our College of Music into its current status. From a rather small and insignificant school, starting in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and right on up through, we have had a major, major college that I don't think most people today recognize the history that's behind where we stand today, but it's a long and distinguished one. And we should all be very happy to be here, as we are, right? So if we were to work on this any further, we certainly would have to study the copyright status of the various pieces, find out if there are heirs to the debt estate, if there's more information at the Battle Creek Church. And as I said, maybe someday some of us will get together and look into publishing some of the debt pieces that have really gone out of print and out of circulation. Thank you for your attention. I know that some of you would like to be somewhere else right now, but I thank you for coming, and there are refreshments, courtesy of Professor Jennings and his wife. So, any questions? No? Okay. If you're afraid to ask in public, well, go ahead. Yes, Harlan?
Yes, when you started on this, started playing detective, which of course is what any researcher does, Where did you find the biographical information? Was that mostly in the obituary in Battle Creek, or were there other sources that you discovered you could tap?
Well, actually, I forgot to mention in my last page here, the bibliography. There were things in the papers, the newspaper clippings that were nowhere else. And that's why, you know, mention of these manuscripts does not appear anywhere. If it had not been for those newspaper articles writing the obituary and the fact that these pieces were fresh from his hand shortly before he died, no one would know of their existence or what they were. They would not know what Brooks Miller was or the other piece. But then there are a number of books, although I think there a lot of them are, it's time for something new. I did put up the bibliography here with the University Archives collection and three books about Dett. The Ann Simpson Follow Me, The Life and Music of Dett. The Nathaniel Dett Reader is interesting because it contains all of Dett's own published materials. His articles and short books and pamphlets, everything that he wrote is contained in that one. And then there's another one about life and works. But the newest one is 1993, and that's, you know, quite a number of years old. So there's probably scope for some additional work. And the acknowledgments were, of course, the archives, Teresa Moore, who is our graphic artist and helped put the slideshow together, the members of the Russian Chorus and the Emmanuel Church Choir, Ron Juntin and my husband, who made the recording. We had one plan to record it, and the big recorder didn't work, so this was recorded on a small recorder. And the map was courtesy of Kathleen Weese's in the map library, here in the library. Yes?
Thank you so much for that talk and the information. As talented as Dett was, he had to teach at historically black colleges and universities because of the Jim Crow structure of America at the time. Can you talk a bit more about how Jim Crowism showed up in his life and perhaps limited or restricted him from certain opportunities?
Most of the books don't come, you know, most of the biographical information doesn't come right out and say so, but, you know, if you read between the lines, the fact that he was always going, having to go to the black colleges, and they were the ones who came to him and said, "We want you here." I think that's a part of it. Now, had he lived longer, it's possible that he would have had other opportunities, you know, a little bit later as society opened up a little bit more. But because he died at the age of 61 in 1943, things, I think, you know, prior to the war were not as open as they might have been later. But definitely, he straddled, in some ways, he straddled the communities, because the people in New York and Ontario, for example, the two cultures and however many other cultures there may have been there, you know, basically the black community and the white community, let's say, all supported him. And so in there were pockets of places, and Oberlin College supported him and others like him. So there were places where people definitely tried to break down those barriers, and then other times where it was a problem. Certainly, probably, you know, based on other things we've read too, we know that when they traveled, they were probably, if they were in the South, we even know this from the 1950s sports teams. If players from MSU were African American and they went down South, they had restricted where they could live, where they could stay in hotels and so forth. So they would have faced that on their tours. But apparently when they were in Europe, they didn't face as many of those obstacles. They were much more accepted wherever they went. But all of the audiences, even the skeptics, loved the music they performed, no matter what their prejudices may have been for or against when they came to a concert that he or his choirs were doing. They ended up being won over. So he performed a service, whether he planned it that way or not, he did help bring many different communities of people together, you know, even including the ones who loved classical music and the ones who would rather have heard jazz or blues or, well, it wasn't rock and roll in those days, but any other kind of popular music. You know, he was able to bridge many of those gaps. I don't know if that's sufficient to answer your question, but I see him as someone who he knew who he was. He was not afraid to stand up and say, I'm an African. Well, he probably didn't call himself African-American. He probably called himself, I'm a black composer, conductor, musician, and I'm out here to be the same as the rest of you and to be as good as anybody else on earth, and to stand up for himself if he was ever challenged. Does that help answer your question? Anyone else? Okay, again, I thank you for coming. And I should thank Rick and Grace from the Digital Media Center for helping with all the technology tonight. Couldn't do it without it.